Ladies and gentlemen, we are now beginning the conference call. If you get disconnected during the call, please call 1-888-409-6709. Again, the number to get reconnected is 1-888-409-6709. At this time, your line is muted and will continue to remain muted during the conference. To ask a question or if you have a comment, please press star one. If at any time during the conference you need assistance, please press star zero. I would now like to introduce Dr. Joanne Carter, Executive Director of Results, Inc., located in Washington, D.C., to open the call.
Thanks very much, operator, and welcome everyone to the Results Global National Conference call for February 2014. And I want to say a special welcome to our new activists in Rapid City, South Dakota, and also anyone else who's on the call for the first time. So welcome. If I sound a little far away, apologies. I'm in Amsterdam, where I've actually been with advocates and program implementers, health program implementer leaders from around the world, really spending time planning in many ways how we can leverage and take advantage of the great work that you've done to get that U.S. $5 billion pledge to the Global Fund, and again, how we can leverage that U.S. commitment to the Global Fund to engage other donors, and that's both government donors, but also private sector donors, like other really interesting strategies that could help leverage money for the Global Fund, and also how we can use those resources to even more aggressively accelerate progress against the diseases. So we actually get to the end of these diseases, in really defeating them in the next 10 to 15 years. I want to say also that prior to being in Amsterdam, I was in South Africa with the Minister of Health of South Africa, Minister Motsoaledi, and the minister chairs the board of the Global Stop TB Partnership, and I'm the vice chair, so I had the opportunity to be with him and talking about these issues. And what really struck me again there was this massive burden of HIV and tuberculosis that South Africa faces, but also this incredible commitment of the government that's there now, and particularly of this Minister of Health, and the degree to which funding from the Global Fund has really, you know, while South Africa is putting a lot of this money in, most of it themselves, the funding from the Global Fund has been incredibly important to support them to be ambitious on HIV, and they've set goals to cut new infections in half, to get 80% of people on treatment, and also to cut TB infections and TB deaths by half. And South Africa, you know, of all the new TB diagnostic machines in the world, the majority of them are actually being used for scale-up in South Africa. So it's been quite remarkable, and South Africa is really looking to, use, again, mostly invest domestic funds in this, but really to use Global Fund money to help them scale up and be ambitious. So it was really a great example of how we can actually support leadership in the Global South, and how we can also, and ambition, and also how our resources in many ways are just bridges for leveraging a lot more domestic funding in many countries. So I think it's a really positive, really good story. Today's call is particularly focused on our work to impact the appropriations process. And that, as many of you know, is the congressional process that's going to determine how we spend our development assistance dollars as well as all the rest of our money. And in just a few minutes, John Fawcett, our legislative director, will say a lot more about our priorities and strategy, and there'll be a chance for a back and forth with all of you on this issue. But I mostly wanted to just say that we're taking the time to focus on this today because of how incredibly important this process is, and really how incredibly influential your engagement is. I want to really remind you again, or for those of you that are new to this, that you may, you know, the good news and the bad news is that you may literally be the only ones engaging at this kind of a detailed and informed level with your congressional offices on these funding decisions for these billions of dollars that will or won't be invested in ways that can save millions of lives, get the most marginalized kids in school, get resources in the hands of very poor women. And the work that you're doing, that you're going to be doing on this, not only has you engaged in this process, but in many ways, you're going to be the ones to engage your own members of Congress in this process who may care about these issues, but wouldn't necessarily themselves weigh in on some of this stuff if you didn't ask them. And I want to share a story. From a congressional ally of ours, I was in the cafeteria in the Longworth House Office Building, one of the House Office Buildings, right before the holidays, and I ran into a congressional staffer who we've known for many years, who works for a member of Congress who's a strong ally of ours. And so he started out just by talking spontaneously about how great the local volunteers are, but he also said something that was really extremely telling to me related to our appropriations work. And his boss does not sit on the appropriations committee, the committee that makes decisions on this. And he was telling me, really without my asking, just sort of telling me the story, that many years ago when the local results volunteers first came to him and asked that he and his boss talk to the key leaders on the appropriations committee about these important international anti-poverty issues, he said he actually thought they were kind of crazy because his boss didn't sit on the committee. His boss didn't necessarily have jurisdiction over these issues. But then because we asked, they did it. And he said he found that it really worked, you know, that it was a way that his boss could engage on this issue and have an influence and felt empowered to influence these issues in a way that they had not been doing themselves before. And he said he realized that we weren't crazy, but they were really that we were ahead of them in thinking about this process and in many ways how to help them as members of Congress weigh in. So, again, that was shared spontaneously, and it really reminded me that, you know, even when you sometimes occasionally will get initial pushback on these issues, that we are not only ourselves really playing an influential role on this, but we are allowing our members of Congress and our allies in Congress to really play an influential, direct role that they wouldn't do if we weren't asking them and if we didn't build the relationships such that they would take this on. So I really want to thank you for this and just remind you that it's really, really important, and you really are having a kind of influence that very, very few grassroots activists have on these issues that matter hugely. I want to end just by personally urging every single one of you on the call and your partners and allies who aren't on this call to attend the 2014 Results International Conference, June 21st through 24th of this year. It's going to be our biggest conference ever and really a transformational time for our work, I really do believe. We're really excited to have confirmed some new speakers, and that includes just in the last couple of days, Marion Wright Edelman, the founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund, civil rights leader, children's advocate, winner of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and Results Board member. She's really an amazing advocate and speaker. And we really want to talk with her about what's it going to take to end poverty and end child poverty in this country, like that we can have goals for this country just like we do for the world on eradicating poverty. We also have confirmed nationally syndicated columnist Michael Gerson, whose column appears twice weekly in the Washington Post, is a really eloquent writer and advocate on a whole range of global health issues in particular, but really interesting because he was previously top aide to President George W. Bush and was a key advocate in the administration on the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, and also was Bush's senior speechwriter, so someone who has huge insight into that whole world and is also a passionate advocate and journalist on these issues. And also David Bornstein, who's a journalist and author. He wrote that wonderful piece last year about Results and Citizens Climate Lobby that was in the Fixes column in the New York Times. David actually co-authors that Fixes column, which explores solutions to major social problems. And he also is a co-founder of something called the Solution Journalism Network, which actually supports journalists who report on constructive responses to social problems. So I think there's a way that we can really build an interesting partnership with these folks going forward, as well as learn a lot from them. And finally, I want to say our keynote, as you know, for the conference will be World Bank President and longtime ally Jim Kim. And our plan for the conference is not just to have Jim Kim come and talk with us, and we'll be inspired and we'll ask him some questions. It's really to solidify our partnership with Jim and plan with him how we can work together to deliver on the goal he launched to eradicate extreme poverty on the planet by 2030. So I really want each and every one of you there to be a part of this moment and also to bring our collective voices and vision to Congress and to the World Bank. The conference registration page is open, so please register and please encourage your partners to attend. And also for those of you 18 to 28, or for young leaders that you may know who aren't on this call, please check out the Real Change Scholars Program. It's a scholarship program, an opportunity for young leaders to not only attend the conference, but also to be part of an ongoing leaders program throughout the year. So a really exciting opportunity, and we want to build that out even more and bring something like 100 young leaders to the conference this coming year. So I really hope that all of you can make it to the conference, and I thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for the work that you're going to do on the really important appropriations process. So I'll stop here, and I will turn the call over to our legislative director, John Fawcett.
Thanks, Joanne, and hi, everyone. Nice to talk to you all, and really looking forward to the work that we're going to do this year on appropriations, which is what I want to spend some time talking about today. Appropriations, as Joanne talked about, is the annual process by which Congress decides how much is going to be spent on what. Given the budget pie, how big is each slice? How big is the slice that goes to the Global Fund or Gavi or the Global Partnership for Education? And it's some of the, as Joanne alluded to in her conversation with this aid, some of the wonkiest, most kind of inside baseball stuff that we do, but it's also some of the most important. And the U.S. system is really even unique in the sense of just how much power Congress has to make these decisions and our position as citizens and constituents to influence those decisions. So I will leave some time for some questions at the end. If we get a little bit too wonky, please feel free to ask at the end, and hopefully by the end you'll have a good sense of where we need to go and a bit of also of what we've accomplished. So two things I want to talk about. One is a bit of a recap of how we did on our appropriations work for the current fiscal year that we're in, FY14. How were the appropriations decisions resolved? In other words, what's the outcome of all the work that we did on appropriations going back to this time last year? And second is to look ahead to FY15 and really kick off our work there, talk about what our priorities are, some tips for making appropriations requests, and some insight into the process this year that might be a bit unique to this year. So first of all, FY14, the current fiscal year where we've already had decisions made. And working on appropriations is an exercise in delayed gratification. You have the president's budget request coming to Congress. It's usually released in late winter or early spring. Then the Appropriations Committee takes up that budget request, and specifically the Foreign Operations Subcommittee, the one that deals with foreign aid. They get input from other members. They hold hearings. They draft a bill. They may pass that bill out of subcommittee or even the full committee, or maybe not, by, say, June. And then nothing. Then nothing happens, usually for months. It's pretty typical. You'll get these months of inactivity, and that can be especially true of the Foreign Operations Bill, which is not – it's not something that members are trying to pass before they go home for a congressional recess as a political priority, as opposed to some other pieces of appropriations legislation. And then finally, when Congress is forced to act, they often do so either just as a continuing resolution, meaning we'll just sort of fund things the same way we funded them last year, or as what's called an omnibus, which is a giant appropriations package where everything kind of gets smushed together. So it's not necessarily the most immediately rewarding kind of advocacy, but these decisions do eventually come, and all this advocacy does eventually come to fruition. And what happened in FY14 really bears that out, because the decisions that Congress ultimately made are really exceptionally favorable to our priorities, given just how difficult the budget year it was. So again, just to recap, Congress provided $175 million for Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccines, and that fulfills the three-year, $450 million Obama administration pledge that we worked on back in 2011. That's exceptionally important, particularly as Gavi is going to be trying to raise even more money next year. They protected funding for the Global Fund at $1.65 billion, and that would be the first year of President Obama's new three-year, $5 billion challenge pledge to the Global Fund. Congress rejected the president's proposed cut on bilateral tuberculosis programs and restored funding to that account, and also protected funding for microfinance and basic education, and also included language authorizing a contribution to the multilateral global partnership for education, something else we'll be working on. So there's a bit of a mouthful, and there's a blog post that kind of captures all of this in a bit more detail, but just to say that the work that we did last February and March and April on the appropriations process was eventually resolved and with very positive results. So looking ahead to FY15, there's a couple of ways that we're going to ask our members of Congress to support our appropriations request. One is that each member of Congress can submit their request to the Appropriations Committee, what are called wish lists. And the Appropriations Committee will sometimes literally count how many requests they got for any particular issue when they're trying to make these decisions. Second is what Joanne talked about in terms of additional personal outreach that members of Congress can make to the heads of these committees and subcommittees, which can be enormously important. And third, there'll also be a round of kind of sign-on letters that members of Congress can add their name to a letter to the Appropriations Committee requesting support for a particular program. And the timeline for all of this is that the President is going to release his budget request to Congress in early March, probably about March 3rd, and then additional details about the budget will come out a little later in March. Throughout March and April, these sign-on letters will be generated, the committees will hold hearings, and they'll start to draft their bills, and then by May or June, they may be actually passing these bills out of committee. And one of the things about the timing of our international conference this year is that some of those decisions may actually still be in play by the time you all join us in Washington for the international conference. A couple things I want to say about the dynamics of the appropriations process, which may be a little bit different this year than they have been in the last couple of years. Some factors sort of working for a smooth appropriations process and some factors working against. So in its favor, the appropriations process has going for it that the FY15 budget level is essentially already decided. This was part of the big agreement that Congress reached in order to reopen the government following the shutdown last year. And so sometimes the argument or decision about how big the overall budget should be, in other words, how big the pie should be, really impedes this process of deciding how big the slices should be. This year we already know how big the pie is going to be, and so at least theoretically, and I think probably the process should run a little bit more smoothly. That means you'll have a quicker and more regular process where the appropriations committees are going to do hearings and markups and things like that. That's a real opportunity, particularly for folks that sit on those committees, to have some input rather than a small group of people kind of behind a closed door at the end of the fiscal year trying to make these decisions very quickly. The other dynamic, though, is that it is, of course, an election year, and that has the tendency to slow things down. Both because members want to be back home in their states or their districts campaigning, and also just because there is a possibility that the control of the Senate will switch from the Democrats to the Republicans. So the Republicans may not want to pass appropriations bills until after the results of the election, so they can kind of hedge their bets. That's not a particularly partisan statement. That's just kind of a fact of life that we'll be dealing with this year. That said, again, these decisions will eventually be resolved, even if it's not for many, many months, and the input that we're going to provide over the next 2 to 3 months are going to be critical in how those decisions are ultimately made. So we've got I want to talk about a few kind of tools and tips we have for sort of making these requests. We have the February action sheet, which at a kind of summary top level walks through how to make a request of your member of Congress to include our priorities in their priorities when they make requests to the Appropriations Committee. And there are request sheets for each issue that are separate. So there's a separate one-pager on our global health issues around the Global Fund and tuberculosis, around Gavi and maternal and child health, as well as education for all, and with a particular emphasis on the Global Partnership for Education, and on microfinance, making sure that these appropriations bills include language that enforces the requirement that microfinance be directed to the very poor. And these one-pagers are designed that you can share them directly with your member of Congress as you make these requests. And so a couple of tips about that is that some members of Congress, as they collect these appropriations requests from their constituents, some folks like us, although not very many, are going to be asking, you know, for something like $200 million for the Gavi Alliance. They're also going to be getting requests like, you know, I want $5 million for this bridge project in my district. So in order for them to kind of collect all of these things, sometimes they'll have a form that they'll ask you to fill out in order to make this request. Some of these forms, they're not really designed to handle, they don't really have something like Gavi in mind. They have something like a bridge in mind. So if your member of Congress does have a form like that, please do contact us on staff, and we can help you kind of navigate that and help you fill that out. And I think a really good place to start with all of this is to reach out to your congressional office, and this is something that, you know, somebody could send an email today to an aide in the office, and ask whether or not that office has a deadline for when they want to receive appropriations requests and whether or not there's a form associated with that. Now, we're early enough in the process that the answer may be, look, we don't have a deadline yet, but at least you're kind of on the radar then, and they can get back to you when that deadline is set. And that's kind of a, just at least a good way to start, so you know how much time you're sort of working with to get these requests into our members. And then I think probably most importantly is to sort of not stop there, not just send an email, not just fill out a form, but to try to follow that up with at least a phone call, if not an in-district meeting with staff or with the member, to really press the case as to why these particular issues are so important to us, why we need to, you know, fund the Gavi Alliance to make sure that kids get access to vaccinations, fund the Global Fund in TB so we can start to break the backs of these infectious disease epidemics, provide increased financing to the Global Partnership for Education to get all kids a quality education, and to make sure that our microfinance dollars are going to the poor women borrowers that need the most. And finally, I think one of the things about this whole process, which is really important, is you know, when we meet with our members of Congress, when we meet with congressional aides, a lot of times what we hear, not always certainly, but a lot of times what we hear is, hey, I support you on these issues. I'm with you. But members of Congress don't have a lot of opportunities to make a vote on the floor to demonstrate that support, right? It's not like there's a big foreign aid bill, or certainly any foreign aid bills that are necessarily coming to the floor that members of Congress can say yay or nay on. So this is how they support us, right? This kind of inside track of expressing these priorities to the Appropriations Committee is how they're actually able to make that support real. So I hope that's a helpful overview. Again, we've got a lot of tools on the website to kind of walk through additional details and talking points on each of these requests. I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to ask if there are any questions that I can help answer.
And then if you want to ask a question, to hit star one on your phone. And, John, while we're waiting for the folks to chime in here, I wanted to just reiterate what John says about the making the request and staying with them. We've gotten actually much more feedback in recent sessions of this work on appropriations from members of Congress, really confirming for us that they've made specific requests, that they've had conversations or they've sent letters. And that's what we want to get back from our members of Congress. Not only do we want to make the request to them, but we would like them to let us know how they have weighed in with the Foreign Operations Subcommittee. And, again, more and more of them seem willing to kind of get back to us with a bit of that information.
We have a question from Moreno Valley.
Hi. Can you hear me, John?
We can. Go ahead.
Good. This is Lynn Catalano in California. And we have some freshman members of Congress. And because this is inside baseball, I'm just curious, is it possible that new members of Congress may not even know that this wish list possibility exists for them? And so at our face-to-face meetings with them, should we educate them that this is their opportunity to weigh in on these kind of issues if they're not on the relevant committees?
Lynn, that's a really good question. I would say is I think you're right. I think particularly if you have a freshman member, but maybe even if you don't assume that this is something that they are particularly familiar with. And I would maybe start there with are you planning on submitting appropriations requests? Is this, a process that you're familiar with? I would think that by now that members may have been briefed about this. And then the other thing that when it does come out, we can share it out with everyone, with group leaders and everyone else. But the other thing that should happen is that a lot of times the committees themselves will send out some guidance that's sort of to all members about appropriations requests. So when that comes out, that's a bit more official, and that's something that you could also share with your congressional office. But I think I think you're right to not assume a high level of knowledge or sophistication about this process. And as Joanne even said in terms of that the anecdote that she relayed at the top of the call, even members and staff that have been doing this for a while, if they're not on appropriations committees, it may not be top of mind, and they may be dismissive of the possibility of something like a personal conversation with the chair or ranking member of a subcommittee having an impact. But it's our experience that it certainly does.
Thank you.
Your next question is from Orange County.
Two short questions, if I may. One is that we have a congressman, his name is John Campbell, who prides himself on never having voted for a foreign aid bill. He's retiring, and we sort of know who his successor is going to be. Is there any possibility that this will still be an issue in January of 15 so that we should start cultivating and working with the likely successor? And question number two, John, I've never been clear on how far down the list of accounts and sub-accounts and sub-sub-accounts the budget agreement goes. I know it sets firewall parameters for the 14, I think, major appropriations bills, but does it reach down into the account level and the sub-account level?
Those are two really great questions. I'm going to start with the second one. So the question here is when Congress reaches a deal on something like an overall budget cap, or last year when we had sequestration cuts, does that apply to just the overall aggregate level, or does it apply equally or proportionally to all the sub-accounts and sub-sub-accounts? In other words, do these kind of budget deals apply just to the pie or to the slices or to the even tinier slices within the slices? The short answer is I don't know, and the somewhat longer answer is even very informed people that should know don't also seem to know the answer to that question. I've actually asked that exact question to folks at, for example, the Office of Management and Budget, which is tasked with writing the president's budget, and you'll actually get varying answers. What seems to be the case is that those kinds of budget agreements are sort of legally binding at a fairly top level, at kind of the biggest account level, like all of international affairs, for example, and there's sort of discretion below that about whether or not cuts and caps are applied proportionally or those things can kind of be spread around. I think that what's been clear the last couple of years is that Congress is sort of willing to particularly appropriators take pride in their role in making these decisions, and they are not necessarily going to be bound by applying a cut or an allocation proportionally across everything within an appropriations bill. And we actually saw that in FY14, where despite an overall lower allocation for international affairs spending, Congress basically held the line on global health and a number of other anti-poverty priorities, and even provided some increases in a couple of areas in global health, and took that essentially from somewhere else, and some accounts that are probably less poverty-focused, actually. So I think from an appropriation standpoint, they are sort of willing to kind of move things around. To your first question, I would say a couple of things. So first of all, just to not entirely maybe lose sight of John Campbell or perhaps other members like him that pride themselves on not voting for appropriations bills, I think one thing to say to members like that is, there's going to be money that's going to be spent, right? Like, and this, what we're asking you is not about the total amount of how much is going to be spent on foreign aid. What we're asking you is, how is that money going to be allocated among the things that we think are the most effective and have the biggest impact on people living in extreme poverty? And so, as long as that money is going to be spent, we're asking you to help be our voice for how those things could be allocated. Now, I realize that's easier said than done, and members may not be persuaded by that, but don't necessarily be, rebuffed by an argument that, look, I don't think we should be spending money on foreign aid, or I don't think we should be spending as much. We're clearly going to spend something. What we are asking our members to do is weigh in on that allocation in terms of this particular process. And to your point about, if will this still be a live issue in, early next year, the answer is very likely yes, because of what there's a strong possibility of that because of, what happens in the elections. And then, frankly, even if things are resolved before we get into the next Congress, I think even separately from outside of appropriations, I think connecting with congressional candidates, especially ones that seem to be very strongly likely to be in the seat, is a really excellent, excellent idea. I know there are a number of groups that have started to do that and would really encourage folks to be doing that as well. We may have time for one last quick question if there is one.
Our next question is from Tucson.
Hi, Kim. This is Sally Withers in Tucson. On the Global Action page on the website, we were able to access the fact sheet for the Maternal Child Nutrition Act and also one for Education for All. But are there any other action sheets, like one-page sheets, concerning Gavi or microfinance or any of the other actual areas of concern that would be a good page to or a good one-page list of facts to print out to be able to use for face-to-face meetings?
Mm-hmm. So on the appropriations page, which is just results.org/issues/appropriations, and we'll make sure that that link is in the notes, there are five sheets. There's so one for the Global Fund, one for bilateral tuberculosis, one that is child health and nutrition, including Gavi, one for the Global Partnership for Education, and one for microfinance. So all of those should be up and working. If they're not, maybe you can email myself or Ken separately. And then in terms of additional materials, I know that one thing that we'll be coming out with very, very soon is some additional materials on particularly the Global Partnership for Education, just because that's going to be such a big priority for us in the first half of this year. If you're finding that you want and need additional information, or there are specific talking points you're trying to orient to the interest of a particular member, that could be, look, I know my member is really interested in, Ethiopia, or I know they're really interested in, South Asia. Do you have some factoids or something like that? Please do let us know, and we can help you try to generate that kind of material.
Great. Thank you. So you said it was under the on the website, it's /issues/appropriations?
That's right. Yep.
Thanks very much.
You bet. So thanks, everyone. Really appreciate, again, as I said, this is some kind of inside baseball stuff, but it really does matter. It really is important in terms of how these precious dollars are allocated. With that, I'm going to sort of bring my section to a close, and I want to introduce our Education for All campaign manager, Tony Baker, who's going to give you just a bit of a snapshot of some of the things we're looking at and have been working on with respect to education, and particularly the Global Partnership for Education. This is both an opportunity for you to hear a bit from Tony. He's not necessarily always on these calls, but you're going to be hearing from him quite a bit more over the next couple of months as our education work ramps up. So I wanted to, you know, introduce you or reintroduce you to Tony, and also just consider it a bit of an appetizer for what's going to be happening in the next couple of months with us really ramping up our work on the Global Partnership for Education and the pledging event that they have coming up in June. So thanks, everyone. I'm going to turn it over to Tony.
Great. Thanks so much, John. Good afternoon, everyone. First, I'd like to mention some of the more compelling points that came out of the 2013-2014 Education for All Global Monitoring Report that was released a couple weeks ago that some of you may have already seen. While we know that there's 57 million children, or about 1 in 10, who are out of school, the report highlighted how that global figure masks the education realities that marginalized communities are facing. In sub-Saharan Africa, for example, 1 out of 4 girls aren't receiving a basic education. And at current rates of progress, the poorest girls in sub-Saharan Africa won't achieve universal completion of primary school until the year 2086. The report calls attention to the fact that struggles on the education front are not just in terms of access to school, but also the quality of education provided in them. 250 million children are not learning the basics in reading and mathematics, both due to barriers that keep children out of school, but also because of the low quality of education in many developing countries. That's nearly 40% of children worldwide that aren't being taught the most basic literacy and numeracy skills. Meanwhile, global aid to education has been declining in recent years. Disbursements, or money that has actually gotten out of the door for education, has dropped 2 years in a row, and basic education in specific has taken the bulk of these cuts, dropping by an alarming 24% between 2010 and 2012. So I just wanted to provide a little bit of that kind of background as we're what we're looking at as we're walking into the Global Partnership for Education replenishment campaign, because this whole situation really places our work and the upcoming pledging conference for GPE at a critical moment for education. You may have seen the reports that we released in November that were part of a monitoring exercise that we conducted on the previous 2011 pledge that the U.S. made to GPE. As part of that research, we conducted field visits to Liberia, South Sudan, Tanzania, and Zambia to learn more about U.S. education programs and how the U.S. works with GPE structures on the ground. Some of the greatest takeaways from the research illustrate how GPE's approach of working through government systems and building government capacity to deliver services really complements the U.S.'s own project approach to education development. So these findings and more messages discovered from this research can be found on the reports link that will be shared with this call. And we'll also pass along links to our recent blog posts on these reports and the latest Education for All Global Monitoring Report. Thanks. I really just wanted to jump in there and you know, kind of provide, as John said, that snapshot of what we're looking at and kind of our launching off point as we move into the GPE replenishment campaign. And really, I'm looking forward to working with all of you as we really seize the opportunity for GPE's pledging conference to set things on the right track. Now I'd like to pass it over to our global grassroots manager, Ken Patterson, for the Grassroots Cafe. Thanks.
Thanks much, Tony. Yeah, this is Ken Patterson with the Grassroots Cafe. Wow, I feel like Fox News. So, hey, I want to start the cafe by picking up where the brilliant Tony Baker left off. I don't know about you folks, but frankly, I'm pretty outraged by the numbers that I saw in the UNESCO Global Monitoring Report on Education. You know, we have to ask ourselves, how is it possible that 38% of all children in the world of grade school age cannot read or do math? To me, it's absolutely mind-blowing, and we've got to ask ourselves, what do we need to do differently to change this? Because though we are making progress on this, we've repeatedly broken our promises to the world's children. Think about this. The first real promise we made to educate all children happened in 1948 with the UN Universal Declaration on Human Rights, which states, everyone has a right to education. Education shall be free, at least at the elementary and fundamental stages. Then in 1959, the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights states that every child is entitled to receive education that shall be free and compulsory, at least at the elementary stages. Then at the World Conference for Education in 1980, a goal was set to provide all the children with a basic education by the year 2000. Then the Education for All Forum in Dakar in 2000 helped craft what became MDG number 2, the Millennium Development Goal number 2, to have all kids receiving a basic education by 2015. And we're clearly not going to hit that target. So something's not working. It's been 66 years since the world has declared that all children have a right to an education, and we are only 62% of the way there. You know, I've missed goals in my life, and sometimes significantly, but I've never had, you know, 66 years to get it right. And this is really why we need to take this issue on with passion and work unapologetically with the media, with Congress, and with our communities to overcome what's going on and to really focus over the coming months on education and appropriations as we talked about earlier. So I want to – here's what I think we need to be doing in the coming months, and I want you to take a couple of notes on this. The first step is, one, to schedule face-to-face meetings with your representatives and senators to discuss all of our appropriations requests and, in the House, the Education for All Act. In those appropriations requests are also the requests for the Global Partnership for Education. Number two, we need to put all of our appropriations requests in front of our foreign policy aides as soon as possible, as John talked about, and we can do this now. The third thing we need to do is to prepare ourselves to work with the media. And we're going to have a media campaign coming up to work on the Global Partnership for Education. And for this, I want to get a few more details. I'm going to ask Colin Smith, our Deputy Director of Communications, to give us some ideas on how we're going to get going. Colin, are you there?
I am. Thanks, Ken.
Yeah, go ahead, Colin.
Thanks. So for those of you who haven't met me, I joined the Results staff as Deputy Communications Director last November, and I am really jazzed for the media push ahead around GPE, and I'm really looking forward to getting to know and work with all of you through that process. And today I wanted to take just a second to give a bit of a sneak preview as to what's ahead, as well as highlight something that we can all do right now to add to that list that Ken was just starting. So as we try to generate media this spring, our top action is going to be setting up face-to-face meetings with editorial writers, just like we are doing right now with members of Congress. And the goals are really similar in a lot of ways. By asking for those in-person meetings to discuss education and request that writers editorialize on this issue, we're not only upping our chances of success in the short term and actually getting an editorial, but also hopefully building that relationship that will bring us continued success in the future. So right now, the staff is working on a whole package of information to support this campaign that we'll be sharing with all of you in the next couple of weeks. It'll include everything from the basics and a how-to regarding editorial board meetings, as well as a tip sheet on building local angles around this issue and recruiting allies in our communities, as well as a series of sample pitches and meeting requests time to different events coming up over this spring. There's also going to be a media support call next month on editorial meetings specifically, and I will offer right now, and you will continually hear me offer, that I would personally be delighted to work with any groups who'd like an extra hand in this work. So stay tuned for all of that, but right now we also have an opportunity to lay some important groundwork on this issue. Before we have a specific request around editorials, I want to encourage everyone to take a little bit of time to reach out to our editors, not to ask them for something, but just to say something nice. Reporters, as you know, and as you can imagine, are constantly bombarded with requests and pitches and people correcting them and people sending angry responses to their work. And so an email subject line that simply says congratulations or outstanding editorial or thanks for your thoughtful piece, it really sticks out. So I'd encourage you to scan the pages this week, see if your local editorial board covers something positive, whether it's education-related or not, if it's something that resonates with you or touches on one of our issues, even if only tangentially, shoot that writer a quick 3 or 4 line email. It's a chance to start establishing or strengthening a relationship that already exists, and it's really about connecting with the human beings behind those editorials who, just like all of us, respond well to positive reinforcement. So leading with a little praise or gratitude really positions us to make an ask later on this spring. So it really only takes 3 or 4 lines, say thanks or congratulations, why the piece is so important, that you're a volunteer with Results, working on a range of poverty issues, and you'd love to stay in touch. And that's really all it takes at this point. So that then when you come back in a couple of weeks and make an ask, you're a familiar face and you're a familiar, friendly face. So it's a great thing to do now, but also really a great habit to form. Anytime you see something in the news that you like, it takes just a minute. I personally fire off 4 or 5 of these emails every week in my work, and I'm always amazed at how much better the response rate is on these emails than on any other email I send. So you'll likely be hearing from me quite a bit as this campaign gets underway, and I'd be thrilled to work with any of you who are looking for an extra hand, and good luck this week, and thanks so much, Ken. Back over to you.
Thank you so much, Colin, and we are extremely lucky to have Colin on staff with us. I'm very excited about him working with the grassroots on this campaign and campaigns beyond this, but he brings a lot to Results, and we're really happy to have him. The first two things were about working with Congress, face-to-face meetings, and putting appropriations requests. The third one was working with the media, as Colin explained, what we got coming up. And then the fourth thing we need to be doing is really to learn about the Global Partnership for Education and education. Global Partnership for Education, and educate your community about the Global Partnership for Education and the work to be done in global education overall. And so in terms of educating your community, the way that we'd like to support you in doing this is the following. One, we've got 2 scheduled webinars coming up where you can learn more about global education and the Global Partnership for Education. One of those, the first one is on February 18th at 1 p.m. Eastern, so a daytime one. We'll do a repeat of that one on February 19th at 9 p.m. Eastern, and that will be led by Allison Grossman and Tony Baker. And you can find details for those calls in the weekly update and also in the notes following this call, which will come out probably on Monday or Tuesday. The next thing you can do to engage your community is to invite them next month on our national conference call on March 8th at 2 p.m., the normal time. So in place of next month's national conference call, we're actually going to have an international webinar featuring Alice Albright, the Chief Executive Officer of the Global Partnership for Education. And the Results Canada is going to be joining us, and Results UK is going to be joining us, as well as some of the other partner organizations who are working on the Global Partnership for Education replenishment effort. So this is really exciting. We're going to structure this as an outreach activity for you, and we will provide you with an outline of how to make that day a nice, productive community outreach activity where we'll have some things to do beforehand, and then you'll have the webinar, and then something to do afterwards. And so you're going to get some more information on that in the coming week, but that's a great way to continue to educate yourselves and your community. So we have a lot of important work to do in the coming months on appropriations and on global education. And so I wanted to give you a little bit of inspiration about, what a couple of our activists have been able to do around the Education for All Act, in particular with their Republican representatives, getting them to co-sponsor that bill and actually opening the door for all of us. So I want to ask Linda Schatz from Tampa, Florida, if she would be able to share with us a little bit about what they've done with their representative. Linda, are you on the line?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Linda. Go ahead.
Hi, everyone. My husband Ken and I were put into the district of Republican Congressman Dennis Ross after the 2012 elections. We forged a relationship with his foreign affairs aide, Kyle Glenn, who did not seem to know much about our issues. Despite repeated requests to meet with Mr. Ross, we have never been able to do that. However, we did meet with Kyle during the international conferences, following up by email and phone. We started asking him to co-sponsor the Education for All Act last summer. We sent him our published media. We sent a short video provided by Results. Ken wrote a letter to Representative Ross and received an unsatisfactory reply that didn't really answer the request. We learned the congressman would hold a town hall meeting in January and that Kyle would also be there. Ken and I went to the meeting, each clutching a paper with our question printed out. We sat on opposite sides of the room, as close to the front as possible, to boost our chances of being called on. At the first opportunity, Ken's hand shot into the air, and Mr. Ross called on him. Ken read his question using words from the congressman's own letter to show that co-sponsoring would require no new funding and could thus satisfy possible objections. Ken ended by asking if he would co-sponsor. He said he didn't see any problem and even asked for Ken's piece of paper, handing it over to Kyle. After the meeting, we chatted with Kyle and his new assistant, Krista. She promised to follow up. A few days ago, we learned that Dennis Ross is officially a co-sponsor. So what really worked here is a persistent professional relationship with staff, using the town hall meeting as the face-to-face, and profiting from the terrific coaching and support we get from Results. Thanks.
Awesome, awesome. That is so fantastic. What a great story and an inspiration. So let's hear now more from Omaha, Nebraska. Are you on the line, Fran?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Fran, let's hear from you.
Good. Six women met with Representative Lee Terry in his Omaha office very early on a cold, snowy Monday morning in January. We had six partners there, and that was a testament to the growth of our group experienced from our Reclaiming Democracy book party in September. Half of our group had not met with him before, and none of us knew his new aide, so we had a full round of introductions. We discovered that his new local aide has seen poverty in rural Uganda. I told him what a terrific meeting Jared and I had with Graham Bufault, his aide, in December in D.C. last July, and what a huge fan of Mohammed Yunus Graham was. Then I asked him if he would rather talk about education or nutrition first. We think this tactic gives them a sense of control and power. He chose nutrition. Our well-oiled presentation felt just right, a good blend of good hard science and great humanity. He said, "Finding sounds like the right thing to do." I about leapt out of my seat, but instead I said, "Let's see now if we can get you to support our education program. You know, we've been talking with you about this for several years." So just as I did that day, I said, "Take it, Elaine."
So then I talked about the Education for All Act and the tremendous benefits that accrue from those kinds of programs in developing countries. And we've talked to him many times about these things before. He said he would check it out when he got back to Washington that afternoon and would sign unless he discovered a problem. We reminded him that we'd never misled him, and that was kind of a reference to the fact that several years ago, as we were leaving his office, he introduced us to some incoming constituents and said, "These people are from Results. They always bring us good information." So we have the research team at Results Central to thank for that. And I think we've just won him over slowly and gradually by repeated meetings with him and by really informing him about some things that he may not be as aware of as we would like him to be. So he wants to be careful that he doesn't offend the Tea Party, or at least he has information that he can present to counteract their arguments. And we thought it was a great day that he was willing to sign on to two of our requests.
So all in all, we think that our winning cards were persistent friendliness and relationship building and the power and diversity of a certain sizable group that day and our year-after-year patience. That's it, Ken.
Phenomenal, phenomenal. Thank you again, you guys again for your great work. We now have four Republicans on the Education for All Act. Our group's in Washington, Nebraska, Texas, and Florida have really cracked the door open and really made co-sponsoring for Republicans a much more doable thing because there are more Republicans already on. We should really take advantage of this, and it will also help us make our case for the Global Partnership for Education Pledging Conference because that is actually in the bill. So by co-sponsoring the bill, they're actually acknowledging their acceptance of GPE as a viable funding mechanism. So great work, folks, on moving your Republicans to co-sponsor that bill. Overall, I just want to thank everybody for the great work that you've been doing on your planning and your face-to-face meetings. Both of these are really critical. I want to note for you that your regional coordinators will not stop asking you for your group plans until that he or she has a copy of them, so do finish those up. And then now I want to turn the call over to Cindy Levin, our grassroots fundraising coach. She's going to give us some great fundraising information about and some other outreach opportunities that are coming up. Cindy, are you there?
I am. Thanks a lot, Ken. This is mainly an update about the Friends and Family campaign. We have listened to our grassroots, we've analyzed our data from the last couple of years, and we have a brand new strategy to share with you for our 2014 Friends and Family campaign. The Friends and Family campaign, instead of being a month-long effort, will be an ongoing campaign from February to October. So any donations that go to Results or Results Educational Fund through grassroots letter writing, emails, or web pages will count towards our overall $25,000 goal for personal fundraising appeals to friends and family this year. So why did we make that change? Mainly, participation in fundraising is changing. More of you are participating when it's best for your personal schedules. Many partners have told us that they enjoy asking their friends and family to give when they feel a personal connection to it, like when they celebrate a birthday, or they run a race for results, or ask around a holiday. Our survey of the grassroots showed that there's no overall consensus about what a good time of year would be for a month-long campaign. So, to help our groups and individual volunteers fundraise at convenient times, we will support you if you want to do a mailed letter campaign, an online birthday campaign with our results celebration websites that could be used for graduations or weddings, excuse me, or if you want to take on a physical challenge with our Results Race to End Poverty website. We will also be creating seasonal online campaigns at three different times of the year. They'll be themed around Valentine's Day, the International Conference, and Thanksgiving. So right now in February, we have a website up called the Valentine's Date Night In, and that campaign will, you can invite donors to stay in for the holiday instead of going out for a date, and donate the cost of a dinner out as an expression of love for the world. After the last call, we got the suggestion that if people can swing it, if you want to match whatever you spend on your Valentine's date night out, that you might want to donate that way as well. So you can get started to ask your friends and family to do that by going to www.tinyurl.com/2014resultslove. If you have participated in the Friends of the Family campaigns in the past, you can expect a phone call or an email from our development staff to help explain these changes and make sure you have all the support you need. Donor envelopes for the letter writing, help with building a website, or general coaching about how to make the most of your campaign are all available to you. And we'll help you choose a campaign that's exactly right for you. If you have not participated in the past, please reach out to your fundraising coaches, Jen DeFranco, or me, Cindy Levin, and we'll be happy to help you get started. So thank you to all our partners who annually volunteer their energy to collectively raise thousands of dollars for us with the Friends and Family campaign. We hope this new strategy will be more fun and successful for everyone. And also, just one last reminder that's on the slide there is always time to thank your donors. And especially since John Foss has shared all this great news, we did not see a cut in any of the programs that we advocated for. And donors love to hear what happened with the money that we sent, that they sent to us. So that is a headline to share. Everything that we advocated for was protected, restored, or expanded. So please share that news with your donors. Ken, back to you.
Thanks very much, Cindy, here. So we've got, I had some polling questions today I was calling the love quiz, but I think we're going to ask the RCs to do that with you on your calls this coming week or via email, just asking you whether or not you're going to be complete your plans and give us a Valentine on Valentine's Day next Friday, and the same thing with your face-to-face meeting request. So your RCs will do the love quiz with you. Cindy, I'm just going to turn the call back over to you and have you train us in some powerful speaking on appropriations with laser talk and then have you close the call. Does that sound good?
I would love to do it.
All right. You got it.
This month's laser talk is about making critical foreign aid appropriations requests of your members of Congress. So we are going to go through the laser talk four times in four different ways. And the point of going through it four times, and the fourth time you'll do it yourself, but the point of doing it is for you to learn and remember the key point of the talk so that you own them and you can use them whenever you need them. You won't always have a piece of paper with you, and you won't need to if you learn the laser talk. So be sure to concentrate and go through it the three times with me and the fourth time after the call, particularly that practice after the call if you really want to own it. So here's the procedure. So listen to the laser talk the first time through and try to remember as much as you can. I'll repeat the laser talk a second time and ask you to shout out information that I leave out. Listen a third time and think the answers to the information I leave out. And finally, that fourth time after the call, pair up and practice the laser talk with someone and just do your best. You won't remember everything in order, but that's not the point. The point is to have the information you need to speak powerfully when you need it. So here we go. First, just listen as I read it. Most Americans think that the U.S. spends 10 to 25% of our budget on foreign aid. When they learn that we spend less than 1% on poverty-focused assistance, many feel that we could invest more. But poverty-focused development assistance has been targeted for cuts in recent years, even though it has a profound effect on saving lives, as well as on the U.S. economy and national security. For example, U.S. investments in child survival have helped cut the number of under five child deaths in half since the 1980s. Investments in the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria have saved millions of lives. And by promoting health and development, we are investing in future trade partners and allies because developing nations purchase 50% of U.S. exports. Our senator, and you could be talking to a representative, but our senator needs to be a voice for effective foreign aid so that successes can continue. I would like the senator to write and speak to the heads of the Foreign Operations Subcommittee of Appropriations. I think the senator would be particularly interested, and right here you'll have to pick an issue. So how may I send you some detailed requests? Now I'll repeat it and leave blanks where you can shout the answer, and please do shout if your venue allows. It's much more fun that way. Here we go. Most Americans think that the U.S. spends how much of our budget on foreign aid? 10 to 25% of our budget on foreign aid. When they learn that we spend how much on poverty-focused assistance? Less than 1% on poverty-focused assistance. Many feel we could invest more. But poverty-focused development assistance has been targeted for cuts in recent years, even though it has a profound impact on saving lives, as well as on what? On the U.S. economy and national security. For example, U.S. investments in child survival have helped cut the number of under five child deaths how much since the 1980s? In half since the 1980s. Investments in what program have saved millions of lives? The Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. And by promoting health and development, we are investing in future trade partners and allies because developing nations purchase how much of U.S. exports? 50% of U.S. exports. Our senator needs to be a voice for effective foreign aid so that successes can continue. I would like the senator to write and speak to the heads of which committees? The Foreign Operations Subcommittee of Appropriations. I think the senator would be particularly interested in which issue. And this will be different for every member of Congress that you talk to. So whatever you said was right. How may I send you some detailed requests? Now this third time, just listen and think the answers to yourself when I leave the blanks. Most Americans think that the U.S. spends how much of our budget on foreign aid? 10 to 25%. When they learn that we spend how much on poverty-focused assistance? Less than 1% on poverty-focused assistance. Many feel we could invest more. But poverty-focused development assistance has been targeted for cuts in recent years, even though it has a profound impact on saving lives, as well as on what? On the U.S. economy and national security. For example, U.S. investments on child survival helped cut the number of under five child deaths how much since the 1980s? In half. Investments in which program have saved millions of lives? Investments in the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. And by promoting health and development, we are investing in future trade partners and allies, because developing nations purchase how much of U.S. exports? 50% of U.S. exports. Our senator needs to be a voice for effective foreign aid so that successes can continue. I would like the senator to write and speak to the heads of the which subcommittee? The Foreign Operations Subcommittee of Appropriations. I think the senator would be particularly interested in the issue of, and you know your member of Congress best, so you were right, how may I send you some detailed requests? Great job. Now, after the call, please practice with a partner, and you will be well on your way to taking an action on foreign aid. And Ken, if I'm correct, this is the point at which we ask the operator, how many total folks do we have on the call and how many sites dialed in?
Correct.
Operator?
There were 62 sites and 163 individuals.
Terrific. So thank you. Now I'll ask everyone to wait a few seconds as the operator opens the lines for everyone so we can wish each other an early happy Valentine's Day. Have a great weekend.
Oh, it is a flower.